It's Thursday, August 8th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. You know, I always thought that a more condensed election schedule will be more conducive to democracy. I look at other democracies and I envy them. In Canada, the election period lasts from 37 to 51 days. In Argentina, you can only start advertising 60 days before an election, and the official campaign itself can only start 25 days before it. We just saw in France, they have really quick elections, 2 weeks long. In the UK, elections are quite condensed as well, although everyone knows they're coming. In America, the answer is technically forever. Someone could announce their run for 2028 right now. Donald Trump was an official candidate for the election to be held on November 5th, 2024. He officially declared that he wanted to win that election November 5th, 2024 on November 15th, 2022. So now that we have a de facto condensed election, I should be pretty happy, right? I'm not. Because I'm cranky. No, it's because in all these other countries where they have short elections, they know they have short elections. So the expectation, I would say the requirement is within that short period, candidates have to answer questions, do debates, engage on issues that they might be uncomfortable with. The public demands it, the media demands it, tradition demands it. It's what they have to do. It's the table stakes for getting elected. But here in the United States, with our attenuated election schedule, there's no means to enforce such a demand. So you might have heard the Republicans and others in the media pointing out, well, Kamala Harris hasn't done a press conference in a long, long time. And that's true. Do I fault her? Yes, as a fan of democracy, getting politicians to answer questions, open inquiry, I do. As a political strategy, she'd be dumb to stop the gravy train of joy. I mean, if I was the Harris-Walls campaign, I would, one, not listen to me, no matter what I said, and two, not do any real interviews or certainly not a full presser for as long as I could play out that string. Maybe, you know, a couple of days before the DNC, you do a couple of sit-downs with a couple of network anchors. Certainly not Fox. Because in 2024, and it's been this way for a while, media attention is necessary for people who try to get it. But once it's on you, it never seems to go well. It's not that the scrutiny is fair, it's just that there are so many avenues to take anything you say and turn it into fodder. And when right now, what's going on is nonstop coverage of the vibes and the joy, you should, if you're a campaign, and this is what the Harris-Walls campaign is doing, you should just vibes and joy your way through everything. And in fact, when it is the media that is clamoring for you to do an interview, when it's the same media that's giving you headline after headline about the joy and the vibes, why would you pay attention to the bummer of having to sit for a full interview? If I did an interview with Harris, I know what I'd ask her, and therefore this is what Lester Holt or George Stephanopoulos or John Dickerson would ask her. Can you make clear what your commitment to Israel is? Can you make clear what your stance is on abolishing private insurance? Should we have more police on the street or fewer? More arrests or fewer? You supported cash bail as a prosecutor. You opposed it officially as vice president in 2019. Well, cash bail has been enacted in many states and municipalities. How's it gone? How's it gone in Illinois, New York, and D.C.? By the way, the answer, let's just take the last one. The answer to that is actually it's gone pretty well, better than what the biggest critics would tell you, certainly better than what the New York Post would tell you. And Kamala Harris's home state, and maybe she knows this, cash bail has had very few negative consequences and has, you know, fairly allowed people who aren't rich enough to go free and not stew in a jail until they show up in court. But that's not an answer that Americans want to hear, especially when they're vibing on the joy or getting joyful from the vibes. So I understand it. The answer to that question might make some people uncomfortable, but what it would do is it would communicate that you're the person who is willing to make tough choices. You're the person who won't say all the time what everyone likes, but will do what needs to be done, which is a pretty good definition of leadership. The thing is, it's not joy. Joy and leadership aren't antithetical, but there are many non-overlapping features. And if you could get all the joy coverage, you don't want to lean into the leadership questions. So right now, we are not in the tough choices leadership part of the campaign, even though in every past campaign, we'd have to be. We're not there yet. With the tight schedule, I believe that phase will come. But if it doesn't come soon, it might be too late. On the show today, we interview a lot of people here on The Gist, and sometimes we get, I'm not going to say a backlog, but I get so interested. I interview two or three people a day, and what do we do? How do we get them out? So sometimes a spiel has to be sacrificed for a person much more interesting than myself, and we'll give you two interviews today. Also, let me mention, because I mentioned this on the show the other day, if you wish to subscribe to The Gist and help us go to the DNC, help us do all the reporting we do, there are several tiers that are available to you ad-free in Pesca Plus. That would be subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now, for Pesca Plus subscribers, and we could possibly open it up to everyone else, I'm running a fantasy football league, not making any money on it, for $100. And the only reason I'm charging $100 is I've been in fantasy leagues without any money, and they always disintegrate. So for $100, if you like fantasy football, you could join the PPFFLL, the Pesca Plus Fantasy Football Listeners League. Email MikePesca@thegist.com and put football in the subject line. Football. On the show today, here are two interviews. So first, we will talk to Kiki Freeman. She is the CEO of Hey Jane. And then we will talk to Mo Rocca about his new book, Rocktogenarians. Let me tell you about Mo first, and then we'll get into Kiki. Mo's a veteran of CBS Sunday Morning. He's a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He was a longtime correspondent for The Daily Show, and he's interested in weird and quirky things in his weird and quirky way. But I don't think old people are really weird or quirky. I mean, maybe to us, the young, and I flatter myself by putting us in that category. But I kind of love old people, and so does Mo. The new book, Rocktogenarians, Late in Life, Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs is the name of it. And we will talk about the electric company, old people, and when to question age in politics. But first, Kiki Freeman is the CEO of Hey Jane. The company operates in 21 states. It gives people access to birth control, medical abortions, and other treatments. We will talk about the efficacy, ethics, and legality of abortion care through the mail. And we will talk about how a company like hers thinks about states that are very open to abortion and then pivots to states that are very much not. Kiki Freeman, up next. Kiki Freeman is the co-founder and CEO of Hey Jane, the leading virtual reproductive and sexual health care clinic. It has 50,000 patients, and Kiki says that it is offering a service that is cutting through not just inconvenient, but in some cases, state-legislated and bureaucratic oppression, suppression of women's rights. It's a really interesting business. It's right at the intersection of, like I said, convenience and sexual reproductive rights. Kiki, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So I know your service is telehealth. I have to tell you, I don't even understand what that prefix means anymore. I mean, I know in Greek it means far away, but is it reproductive services on Zoom? Is that what we're talking about?
That's a very good question. So we are able to provide our care to patients from wherever they choose. For the most part, our patients are actually communicating with us primarily via chat, so totally asynchronously. We do also offer the option for videos or phone calls, but we find most people really prefer that privacy and convenience of just a chat.
Okay, so a customer finds your website and needs to get an abortion. They get in touch with you, and what do you send them? What do you offer? What are the services you provide?
Yeah, so I'll walk through the whole process there. So patients will come onto our site. They'll get lots of really easy to understand information about what medication abortion is, how it works with telemedicine, and how it works with Hey Jane. They'll complete an initial medical intake 24/7 after work when their kids are asleep on their own schedule. We'll get information about their pregnancy and medical eligibility. Typically within 24 hours, within one business day, our provider will get back to them to confirm their prescription if they're eligible. From there, we have a really fantastic pharmacy partner. They mail the medication directly to the patient. That could be to their doorstep, could be to a pickup point. Patients complete treatment at home, and we are with them throughout. They get on-demand support before, during, and after. They could text our team with any clinical questions they might have for emotional support. And then we also have this really cool peer community called The Lounge, where in real time, abortion patients can connect with one another to share their experience and just really normalize and validate whatever they might be feeling.
Is the drug mifepristone that you're sending?
We do the combined protocol of mifepristone and misoprostol.
Right. So it's sometimes called the abortion drug. It is two drugs typically. Do you offer your services in all 50 states?
We are in 21 states right now. We are committed to operating, you know, completely legally and compliantly. And so we are able to operate within those states, and we have a few more on our expansion roadmap.
Mm-hmm. And do all these states have specifically spelled out protocols for what you're providing, or do some of them just not have a ban, which is different from, for instance, in my state, I know that they are welcoming these services and they are wanting to increase accessibility to the drugs you're talking about, and they're eager to get providers such as you signed up. But that is my question. Does everyone have that level of acceptance that you have to follow, or are you operating in some places that simply lacks a ban on it?
Yeah, great question. So for the most part, the states we're in, they're not getting involved in the medical details to any significant extent. But we have seen some really nice laws and regulations roll out there to protect access. Like you mentioned, there are these great things called SHIELD laws that have been rolling out that protect patients, providers, and organizations providing abortion care from cross-state investigations related to reproductive health. We do see in some states they get a little bit more involved. A state that we're looking at now, for example, has a spousal consent requirement. And mm-hmm. So we are figuring out how to work around that. But for the most part, they're not getting involved at that level of detail.
I'm sorry, which is the state with the spousal consent?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania also doesn't have restriction on abortion, and CVS and Walgreens, I don't want to get this wrong, but at least one, if not both of the major drug chains, Walgreens definitely provides mifepristone in Pennsylvania. So I guess it's kind of an odd situation, but I wouldn't think that they'd have a way to ban your service if they're selling it in the drugstores.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We do see some sort of laws in tension, I will say, across states that you might consider to be very progressive. You know, we hope these will get updated and reevaluated as people move forward.
About a year ago, 20 Republican state attorneys general sent warning letters to the drugstores saying that what you're doing is illegal in our state, and we're going to pursue legal action. A couple questions. One, are you operating in any of those states?
We are not.
Okay. Two, the drugstores got criticism because these are national chains for essentially backing down. I understand from a business perspective why they might say that we have to be prudent. In fact, on my show, I said to criticize them was not correct because they do have to be prudent. They do have shareholders. You're in a slightly different position. What was your calculation in not operating in those states?
So the states where we don't operate do have pretty explicit bans on either abortion as a whole, or some of them allow abortion but restrict telemedicine abortion. So they will have in-person visit requirements, that sort of thing. And I would just add that what CVS and Walgreens are doing is amazing and is a bit different from the way we operate. You could think of Hey Jane as sort of like the doctor's office that you'll go into to get the prescription written, the clinical care, and then we send it off to a pharmacy. So in the future, we'll be able to work with these pharmacies to allow for in-person pickup for the patients that we are treating.
But you have your service just will not send to a zip code, or they have to write the state. If the state is not one of these 20 approved, you will not. There are no workarounds. There are no PO boxes. You just flat out say our service isn't eligible in your state.
So yes, a patient who wanted to receive care who lives in one of those states would need to travel into a state where abortion is legal to get care with Hey Jane, but also legally at all.
Mm-hmm. And what about someone bringing it from those a state that it's legal into a state that it's not? You can't control that. You have no way of, ascertaining that your stated patient is really the end patient.
Once we send it fully compliantly. And at that point, you know, we trust that the patient will handle it responsibly and legally. I will say that the DOJ put out an interesting memo about this very issue, and they do suggest that as long as folks are using the mail to send it in a way where they can reasonably expect legal intent, it's okay.
It's okay. So recently, just really a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of FDA versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. maybe that was literally a Freudian slip. And the issue there, it was a 9-0 decision, and it was a victory for mifepristone and many of the services that at least overlap and dovetail with what you provide. But there was also the concern that, let's not read into that as the court actually declaring its intention. There are 9 members of the court. They probably each have different opinions, but it was a standing issue. They just all unanimously decided these aren't the right people to bring the case. They don't have standing. If individuals with standing bring the case, are you worried that the court might ban mifepristone, the online sale, or the directed use of mifepristone and misoprostol?
Yeah. Okay. Great question. So this case was unbelievably spurious from the beginning. Essentially, it was a number of doctors who were claiming they may have suffered damages because they may have needed to treat a patient who may have been suffering from side effects of mifepristone. Side effects of mifepristone are incredibly rare. It is one of the safest drugs available on the market. They were claiming that the FDA rushed the approval of this medication, that there wasn't sufficient data available at the time for them to, have authority to approve that drug. The standing case was clearly flawed here, right? Like, they never suffered any actual damages. It was totally rhetorical. But the underlying issue is also outrageous. There's now decades of safety data confirming the effectiveness and the safety of mifepristone. And so any action to restrict it via this sort of FDA mechanism would be fairly preposterous.
Okay, so I take this to mean that if Justice Friedman were on the court, we know how she would decide. But are you worried, do your legal experts tell you, there is a worry that the court might rule differently with litigants with standing?
So, okay, I think there's two sort of issues at hand here. Listen, they're going to try, the anti-choice folks are going to try other cases, absolutely, to place additional restrictions on these medications. I do think this one in particular is going to be tough. I think there were some somewhat misleading headlines that came out after the case saying that it provided a sort of roadmap for future litigants who wanted to claim they had standing here. It really didn't. It kind of gave the roadmap for other means of intervention going through government agencies and just really the more traditional ways that one might appropriately try to intervene here. I would say there are a lot of things that I'm worried about when it comes to abortion restrictions, but this case is not at the top of my list.
I actually read a lot of your writings or some of the writings that you put out publicly, and you strike this interesting tone, and I understand it's because of your honest belief, but also your motivation, which is, we can clearly discern where your standing is on this issue. You use the phrase anti-choice. That's perfectly appropriate for you to use from both an ethical and business perspective. So we know exactly where you stand. You're foursquare behind reproductive health. And yet at the same time, you're also frequently calling out alarmism over this or that court decision or state decree or local legislature is going to rewrite the laws of abortion. Is there not a tension there? I appreciate that you do that, but do members of the reproductive community or do people you're aligned with not appreciate you doing that sometimes?
That's a very interesting observation, and it's not one that I could say is necessarily intentional, but it does reflect how we feel. I think we're coming at it from the perspective of care providers. And when patients read these headlines that may be misleading or overly hysterical, they get anxious. We see data that shows a lot of people think abortion is illegal in their state when it is not. So creating this unnecessary fear around the issues really does actually pose an additional barrier to care. I do want to say, I think we should be afraid. The situation on the ground right now is bad. Like, I certainly don't mean to undermine the severity of, you know, access restrictions as they exist today. But I do think it's helpful to be measured in and accurate in how we talk about them.
The 20 states you're in, they're, if anything, and I think in the upcoming months, they are, if anything, an, you have an overserved market, whereas the states that you're not in are an underserved market. They could use you more than the states you're in, right?
I would absolutely disagree. I would politely push back about the states that we're in being overserved. I think this is something that people commonly believe, but the reality on the ground is bleak. A few things are going on. Number one, even prior to the Dobbs decision, access across the country was poor. People, even in states like New York and California, were driving hundreds of miles to reach a clinic, walking through crowds of aggressive protesters yelling the most disgusting things you could think of at them, walking through metal detectors, and generally just incurring, you know, unnecessary anxiety, but also cost, right? There's real financial costs that come with that travel, that missed work, those overnight stays, the childcare you may need to get. That has worsened even in so-called access states since the fall of Roe. The number of abortions since the Dobbs decision across the country has actually gone up since that decision came down.
That was a question I was going to ask you, but go ahead.
Yeah, there's a few things driving it. I do think telemedicine is a big part of it, but also we do see patients traveling across state lines to receive care. And what that means is that brick and mortar clinics have had to really quickly absorb this massive surge in demand from out-of-state patients. And so even, again, in these states that we think of as having good access, we hear of wait times of like 2 to 3 weeks. It is still very difficult to get care across the country.
Okay, you make a good case that they're not overserved. But in the states, if you could offer your services to South Dakota, to Louisiana, to Texas, that would be a game changer, not just for them, but as a business, right?
It would be. And there are some interesting sort of regulatory prospects there. A few states, New York, Massachusetts, have rolled out sort of extended versions of those shield laws I was talking about before. They claim that they will protect providers who are physically located in these states from mailing across state lines. Meaning you could be sitting in New York and sending medication to a patient in Texas. If Texas tries to come after you, New York will protect you.
Yeah.
There are providers doing this and it's amazing. And, you know, we absolutely admire the work that they're doing. This will be litigated. You know, it is a legally sort of tenuous situation. And we have really worked hard to form partnerships to drive financial accessibility that may be sort of compromised by taking on that additional regulatory risk.
So why do you think abortion has increased nationally? I understand why it flowed from Texas to whatever the nearest state that might allow it is. But why, New Mexico, why is there a net increase nationally? You have any theories?
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think telemedicine really has made a substantial difference. I think people who otherwise would not have been able to get care now can. And this could be in legal states through a provider like HeyJane or in banned states through providers who are sending medications there. Another thing I wonder about is somewhat of a measurement issue. Because more abortions are happening outside of the formal system, researchers have been more attentive to them and counting them. Those weren't necessarily being accounted for with the same level of detail prior. So I think there's probably some of that. But I do think truly that reducing barriers through telemedicine has probably led to a net increase.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too, that second part. I was thinking there are a couple scenarios. Maybe, well, you would tell me, maybe that there were some abortions going on in, say, a family practice or not an abortion provider, and it would happen, but would not be noted as such for different reasons. And this kind of states where abortion is looked down upon, that might be more likely to be underreported. There might even be incentives on the state level for certain abortion providers. I don't know a scenario why there might be wiggle room to count something as an abortion or not as an abortion. I don't know. I'm thinking of a scenario where there might be a miscarriage, that perhaps there's some ambiguity. And if these are taking place in a state like New York or California, there's no problem with counting it as an abortion, whereas if it took place, to pick on Texas deservedly again, it might be counted. I don't know. These are just ideas I had. Could that be occurring?
Yeah, it may be. I mean, it has been interesting to see how states have approached reporting requirements. California, for example, for a long time didn't do official reporting to the CDC. So they were always excluded.
Yeah, right. All the national statistics would be skewed. But by the way, the biggest state in the country doesn't report.
Exactly, exactly. But we are seeing, I mean, I think there's very good reason for that. Hey Jane actually pushed back a lot against some reporting requirements that were introduced by New York. This is another progressive state, and I truly believe they introduced these requirements with good intent. But given what we may be heading into at a federal level in terms of their attitude towards abortion, like, we do not need more people to have identifiable information on who's getting this type of care.
Kiki Friedman is the CEO and founder of Hey Jane. Thank you so much, Kiki.
Thank you, Mike.
Mo Rocca is a correspondent for CBS's Sunday Morning, a long ago Daily Show correspondent. He's been on many a time, including for his last podcast and book, Mobituaries. The new book is Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs, about old people doing the things in our society that we say they can't do. But when I consider the Mobituaries angle and the Roctogenarians angle, I began to think, are the puns becoming the driving force of his journalism, or just a happy accident? Mo is here to answer all these questions. Hello, Mo Rocca. How are you?
Hi, Mike. And I can tell you right off the bat, the puns are a facilitator, a lubricant. I mean, but I'm running out of names, so that's the problem.
You've got your Mo and you've got your Rocca. What's your middle name?
My middle name's Alberto, and I don't know what you can do with that.
A book on bears, a book on bears' toes, a book on the paw. Yeah, animal paws. You wrote a book on animals. We're going to get there.
I did. Yeah, I love the idea of a book on paws. Yeah.
Is Mo short for Maurice?
It is short for Maurice. I could bring you through something shticky. Like I like to tell people my father was the ambassador to Mozambique in the late 60s when I was born. And generally people go, oh, wow. And I think, wow, you're being overly nice right now. You can just laugh and think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. How did you get, was it just the demographics of CBS Sunday Morning? But how did you get into octogenarians?
You know, It's not just, I mean, it certainly it helps the demographics of CBS Sunday Morning that we, you know, but old people are kind of my jam. I mean, I created this cooking show years ago where I went around the country cooking from grandmothers and grandfathers in their kitchens. And I really think it came from a place. Well, first of all, my father had just died. So I do think that I was kind of looking, I don't know, for answers or something. And I just was drawn to hanging out with old people and hearing from them the kind of things that mattered to them, the two or three things. But what I also found is that, you know, older people, it's obviously a generality, care less about what other people think of them. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, for me, that's kind of aspirational. It also makes them a lot more interesting to interview because I kind of have to go to them. They're not playing up to me. They're not trying to sell me on anything. You know, even when I, for CBS Sunday Morning, if I interview an older person who's plugging a movie, they never really plug that hard. I was just with June Squibb. She's 94. Okay. Yeah, she's 94. She's completely awesome. She's in this movie, Thelma, which is a total delight. It's the first time she's headlined a movie. She's been acting for over 70 years, and she doesn't put on the hard sell. It's really fun to hang out with her.
Same with Morgan Freeman, who I didn't realize because I was a fan of The Electric Company and I was familiar with his work as Easy Reader. But I didn't realize that he mostly is known to us after he became at least eligible for AARP. Is he the same way?
You know, I have not directly interviewed Morgan Freeman. I've never met him. And kind of my dream was to sit down with him and Rita Moreno because they've had sort of intertwined careers. It's sort of interesting when they both, you know, Electric Company is my earliest television memory. I kind of got this thrill every time the show would start and you'd hear Rita Moreno go, "Hey, you guys," I don't know why, just like tapped into something. And so when I interviewed her, when I met her about 11 years ago, I told her that. And we talked about Electric Company. And I thought it was really interesting because Morgan Freeman, they met on that show. And Morgan Freeman was unknown at the time. And he was actually pretty unhappy on the show. And she tells the story, which I don't think he minds. I don't know that. She kind of had to give him a little bit of a talking and speak. She had already had this massive career. She'd won an Oscar for West Side Story, and he was just unhappy. And she said at one point, listen, you got to be on time. You got to take this seriously. But then after Electric Company ended and then he did all these amazing things, she kind of went, oh, now I get it. I know why this guy was really frustrated.
Yeah, because his the wealth of his talents was more than just a guy who would walk down the street like an extra in Starsky and Hutch reading books. Conveying exactly, the joy of the written word, yes. Yeah. Yeah, she was saying to herself, this guy could be the voice of penguins and God.
Yeah, and the thing also, it's I love that when he was asked years ago, what tell me about the struggle of being an older actor, and he said, I can't tell you this about the struggle of being an older actor. I can tell you about the struggle of being a younger actor. I think he also had that thing where he's somebody that had to grow into his roles. He's somebody that sort of was old before he was old, or mature, had gravitas before then. But he also I do think it's really impressive that early in his career, and he walked out of an audition for a commercial because it had a part called The Jew. He quit a San Francisco opera production where he thought that there was a denigrating portrayal of a Native American. So this guy really needed work, but he was a person of such moral rectitude. So it kind of made sense that he ended up playing God in all these movies.
Now, I was wondering where in her egottery was Rita Moreno in the Electric Company era? And I think the answer is she won an Emmy for the Electric Company. It helped her along the way.
She did not win an Emmy for the Electric Company. Oh. And she was three quarters of the way to her EGOT. But the final turn, and I'm suddenly thinking like I'm trying to turn this into a NASCAR metaphor.
Right. Comes down the home stretch as the EGOTery is within grasp.
And then she nails it with the Muppets, with the guest spot on the Muppets, where she does Fever, where she does Peggy Lee's Fever with Animal, and it is hilarious. It's really great. She's so sexy and she's so great. But one thing is, you know, I was obsessed with this commercial growing up for Pepsodent toothpaste, where she's in front of this full length mirror with this ermine stole, and the voiceover went, Rita Moreno, you're the only actress to win an Oscar, an Emmy, a Tony, and a Grammy. And the truth is that she really wasn't. Helen Hayes had her beat by 3 months. This is why, television commercials, the fact-checking was really bad in the 1970s.
Wow. Yeah, maybe Iron Poor Blood wasn't, or Ring Around the Collar weren't the societal scourges we had been led to believe.
I know, and it's really shakes your faith. I mean, no, and so Rita, it's like Helen Hayes had a Grammy, and of course now I really want to know what Helen Hayes won a Grammy for. I mean, I'm sure it was probably like a spoken word album of like Eugene O'Neill or something, but I'd like to believe it was early hip hop.
That's right, done in the performed later the last moments of her life as they named the Helen Hayes Theater. It was her just doing Ice Ice Baby very slowly. Oh, by the way, Rita Moreno, fun fact, Electric Company, she won her Grammy for Electric Company. I just looked
yes,
that
that's
up
right.
as we talked.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. See, this is now, do you think you understand acting? You've been on Broadway, you've been in, well, you're both a journalist and an actor. There are some actors who the idea of them being famous while young, Wilford Brimley comes to mind, always seemed old. It just doesn't really scan. Estelle Getty's also in the book. It took her later in life to gain great fame. But it doesn't seem to me that Morgan Freeman is of that ilk. He had tons of charisma and talent even when he was in his 30s. So what changed for him was his attitude or society catching up to his gifts?
You know, that's so interesting. I think it's probably both. I mean, because I don't know him personally, but going off of what, you know, Rita Moreno has told me and reading about him, I think it probably was both a little bit of attitude, But I think it was society catching up to him. You know, it's funny, these actors who do always seem a little bit older. Angela Lansbury was that way, but for some reason she managed to hit really early anyway.
Yeah.
It kind of worked for her in Gaslight.
Yeah.
You know, she was 18, but there's something so eerie and haunting about her face that she looks like a woman in her 40s at that point.
Right. And infamously, if you're big into age gap discourse, playing Frank Sinatra's mother in The Manchurian Candidate, right, when they were only a few years apart in age.
Yeah. Well, I love stuff like that also, that the ladies of the Golden Girls collectively were actually younger than the leads of And Just Like That, when that started, the spinoff of Sex and the City. The math is a little tricky, but it sort of, it tells you about how our perceptions of age have just changed.
Well, that's
so
a big
much.
Thing. Yeah, I was reading about the Golden Girls, even independent of Rocktogenarians, and it was asserted that the age of those characters were supposed to be, and I couldn't quite believe this, maybe Blanche was supposed to be in her late 50s on that show. I threw it away, but I think that there's something to that, exactly what you said. A 60-year-old in 1987 is something like today's 45-year-old.
Completely. It's wild. Because I think that the actresses on And Just Like That, I mean, not to be weird about this, but they look great. And they don't, you don't think like, oh, wow, they're really trying to look younger. No. And I know Cynthia Nixon a little bit. She's fantastic. But they look the way off camera that they do on camera. They look great. But yeah, I just, there's something about the way people present themselves, maybe also how they take care of themselves.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't know, first of all, we have to defer to lifespans, which have plateaued a little bit. But as lifespans go on and on, and as the quality of life improves, that's just going to change things in terms of perception. A 60-year-old probably today does have more energy and has lived through less hardship and is less likely to have made his or her money through physical labor. So that's all a factor. But then there's the idea of, no one's coined this term yet, but the chronological treadmill, we keep getting the older and older, keep seeming younger and younger. Do you think that's a good thing? There seems to me that there are costs to that, that a 70-year-old who thinks of themselves and doesn't accept being 70, and maybe, I don't know, maybe society looks askance at it as well. Maybe it's just because of my age, which is similar to your age, but it was a little comforting that there was a time, or reassuring that there was a time when an old person could be an old person and not have to be a young person, seen as a young person, or see themselves as a young person.
Boy, that's such a great point. There seems like two different sort of bifurcations going on, one of which I think has to do with healthcare, right? That people who can afford healthcare are going to be living longer and longer, because, right, life expectancy post COVID-ish is rising again. So those who can afford it are, I think, going to enjoy healthier lives longer. But then there's this other thing about, and I hadn't thought of it until you brought it up, that the people that just want to enjoy being old may start feeling pressure, you know, that, wait, what's wrong with you? You know, you're a 73-year-old, you're in good health. What are you doing in that rocking chair? Just, you know, like get up and do something. But there's also a third thing that seems to be going on, and I'm actually about to do a story on it for CBS Sunday Morning, which is the movement towards codifying an upper age limit on elected officials.
Right.
And there is a huge majority. Last year, NPR did a story on it, and 80% of Americans were in favor of this. And I find something weird and kind of dumb about 80% of Americans abrogating their right to elect someone. A strong majority of Americans believe they should be denied the right to elect someone over the age of 75. I understand for appointments, I could understand that a little bit more, but to say it's that, you know, and I believe it's North Dakota, it'll be challenged in court, has already passed this. And, you know, with what we just went through, this drama with President Biden, you know, I think who was the elected official most responsible for getting him to step down?
It was his elder, Nancy Pelosi, was it not?
Exactly, at 84. Right. And were she not still in the House, and look, she gave up a leadership post, but were she not still a member of the House, I doubt that she would. We know that she would not have had that influence.
Right. I totally agree with you. I think, I mean, you and I will both agree that it is somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction to the present circumstances. And most of the people who are saying upper age limit because they're thinking of Joe Biden or were thinking of Joe Biden were very upset about Joe Biden being the president. If you said, all right, what about 3 years younger than that, which is Donald Trump's age? I'm sure they would all say, no, that shouldn't be the upper age limit. And I'll also defer to your point, people abrogating their right to vote for someone, although I guess with term limits, we do this all the time. And with the younger age of voting. But I just think that an 18-year-old's brain is not fully developed, and the vast chasm between some 17-year-olds and some 19-year-olds, that's pretty vast. But when you get to some 70-year-olds and some 90-year-olds, like the Vermont decathlete who I just saw on CBS Sunday morning, it's ridiculous. You can't say there are many, in your book, there are many, many, many 80, high 80s and 90-year-olds who are so much brighter and sharper and more energetic than people have their age.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also think that what's happening a lot is the recall of proper names absolutely slips. But, you know, there are all these studies that show that judgment, and it can mean different things, really sort of takes off. I mean, one thing is that I find, and there's a woman in the book profiled named Mary Church Terrell, a civil rights leader who led sit-ins at segregated Washington, D.C. lunch counters when she was 86. And my co-author, John Greenberg, and I had set out, we wanted to do something with civil rights. And we thought, well, everyone thinks of the young heroes like John Lewis, who was 25 with the, you know, at the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And King was 34 with the I Have a Dream speech. You know, you don't, we at least did not know about older leaders. And I think there's something incredibly poignant about an 86-year-old. And this woman had already led a remarkable life. She was a co-founder of the NAACP. But about somebody fighting for a better world that they are not, even under the best of circumstances, they're going to be able to enjoy for a very short time. It's really powerful. I mean, she wasn't doing it so that she could set herself up with a sweet lobbying job afterwards, you know, in D.C. So, I mean, public servants of that age, I mean, it can be very, very powerful. I mean, it's really selfless. Not in every case. In every case. It can be an ego trip, but, you know.
You know what? The book was interesting and exciting, and I'm glad it sparked many of these insights. But I think I just now want to lay my theory on you, which is when we see a complaint about the gerontocracy, which is the phrase to describe the fact that many of our leaders are in their 70s or 80s, and it's usually the leaders that are pointed to are Schumer, Pelosi, Biden, and then for a little bit of the bipartisanship, Trump. There's something in all of them for most people not to like, but I've always chafed it as unfair, not just because the Pelosi example, she's very good at her job. I think Schumer's very good at his job. I think Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, who's also in his 70s, is very good at his job. We could list a whole bunch of people. I mean, he's 77. We could list a whole bunch of people who are really quite old who rebut the thesis. So I want to talk to you. What do you think about this complaint about the gerontocracy? I think it is inherently ageist. And I also think it serves as sort of a proxy for the people making the case, maybe have more radical or more to the left or more to the right politics of those four individuals being criticized. And I think it serves as a little bit of a vessel for that criticism. But what do you think of this gerontocracy discourse?
Yeah, I think it's really, it's a little bit too easy. I think it's dangerous because, again, if people want to codify this, that's pretty wild because you're basically codifying age discrimination. The one part where I can understand, because politics is so dirty and entrenched, the one part that does make me nervous. You think of somebody like Chuck Grassley. And I think on the one hand, I don't want, because I think is he 86? I probably have that wrong, but he's around there.
90. He's 90.
He's 90. Okay. Yeah. So the issue I have, the big question I have with that, the concern is, Are these people, are their primaries so locked up that no one can even get in there in a reasonable way to challenge them? Is the money and, you know, is the backing so locked up that they're basically in there for life? So that is the part that makes me uncomfortable.
Mo Rocca, along with Jonathan Greenberg, is the author of Rocktogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs, and it ends with an appreciation for Maria Luisa Rocca. It is extremely moving and, as always, a great book and a great pleasure. Thank you, Mo.
Mike, thanks so much.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Ward is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leo Baum is the intern. Michelle Pesca, CFO of Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Umperu, Gperu, Duperu, and thanks for listening.